All right, guys, welcome to the studio today. We are live with StreamYard. We have Summit Ray from Cancer Check Labs, who I met this year at Biohacking 10 in Dallas, Texas, via Dave Asprey. Welcome, Summit.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, glad you're here. So, likewise. Summit, you founded Cancer Check Labs.
That's right. We began developing the technology about 14 years ago, actually. And why I got into cancer was because my only sibling, my younger sister, unfortunately got diagnosed with cancer in 2010, passed away about a year and a half later in 2012. And frankly, from that point, I became very obsessed with trying to figure out how to move the needle on cancer. And, yeah. And so over the past 14 years, we developed a proprietary technology that enables us to extract large quantities of circulating tumor cells from large samples of blood. And because we can do that, that enables previously inconceivable diagnostic and therapeutic applications, the first of which is what we've released at Cancer Check Labs, our Cancer Check test, where, you know, for the audience that's not familiar with cancer, if you have an underlying tumor, lung cancer, breast, colorectal, pancreatic, liver, bladder, brain, skin, any organ tumor, from which over 100 million people a year suffer across the globe annually, the primary tumor itself generally does not kill you. What kills you is the tumor sheds tumor cells that circulate through your bloodstream, known as circulating tumor cells. And the circulating tumor cells, or CTCs, the acronym for short, spread the cancer in your body in a process known as metastasis, and the metastatic effects are fatal. They make your biological organs dysfunctional and you die. That's generally how you die from cancer. You don't generally die from this lump. Now, a lot is known about CTCs, or circulating tumor cells. They have been exhaustively and extensively studied over the past 30 years. A simple Google search would reveal thousands of papers on CTCs. Number one, CTCs are now known to be the primary drivers behind metastasis through the bloodstream. Number two, CTCs are known to be homologous, meaning similar to the primary tumor, because they are literally cells of the tumor that are sloughed off and in transit in the bloodstream. They have the same DNA, the same genome. They are micromodels. They're mini-meats. Number three, CTCs are known to be prognostic, predictive of outcome. High CTC count, bad outcome. Lower CTC count, relatively speaking, better outcome. And that's correlative, not causative. What's causative is high underlying tumor mass, high CTC count, bad outcome. Lower underlying tumor mass, lower CTC count, relatively speaking, better outcome, because outcomes are a function of tumor burden. Number four, CTCs are known to have the same response to drugs like chemo, introducing precision medicine opportunities as the primary tumor, because again, they are cells of the primary tumor. All of this and much more that's been studied on CTCs and vastly documented in research has been done by about a dozen technologies that exist today that have the ability to process between half a milliliter of blood to 9 milliliters of blood. And nobody in 30 plus years has ever come up with really an effective technology to get past 9 mL. And to put that in perspective, 9 mL is 2 teaspoons of blood. The human body has 5,000 mL of blood, milliliters of blood, plus or minus, depending on body weight, typically 4,600 to 6,400 mL. So we spent an enormous amount of money, almost $80 million over the last 14 years, developing a proprietary filter that can process over 10,000 milliliters of blood to extract CTCs. That is a 1,000x, three order of magnitude disruptive breakthrough in cancer. It has profound implications because, as I mentioned earlier, it does give rise to previously inconceivable diagnostic and therapeutic applications. One of those applications, for example, is that the presence or absence of CTCs in your blood is indicative of cancer. If you do not have an underlying tumor, there should not be something shooting off tumor cells into your bloodstream. They need to come from somewhere. They need a source. They don't just spontaneously appear. As a result, if you could take a statistically significant sample, 40 milliliters, not four, and you could detect the presence or absence of CTCs in that blood sample, you could screen the population for cancer. And that's what the first test at Cancer Check is doing. CTCs are interesting in that CTCs share certain physical and mechanical characteristics: size, structure, rigidity, lack of malleability, lack of deformability. They're big, they're hard, they're stiff, they don't bend. These parameters enable us to selectively capture the CTCs on our filters. It turns out that the physical and mechanical characteristics of CTCs are uniform and homogeneous across all solid tumor types and their subtypes. As a result, we will catch the CTCs indiscriminately, irrespective of their source organ, whether they're coming from your breast, your brain, your lungs, your colorectal area, whatever the case might be, which makes it a broad spectrum pan-cancer test for solid tumors. And so once you capture the cells, you can look at the cells for certain protein expression markers to try to trace back the probable tissue of origin. But more fundamentally, what's important is it will detect the CTCs irrespective of tumor type.
That's amazing. You're a wealth of knowledge on all of this. And I actually, as I mentioned before, we met at Biohacking 10. I came right up to you and immediately you shared with me your mission, and I signed up for a Cancer Check Labs test, which was very easy and very convenient. And you have phlebotomists that you're connected to all over the United States. And a trained phlebotomist came right here to my studio, actually. She declined to be on camera. She didn't feel camera ready that day, but I did want to film it. I took some still photos, and I shared those on social media of my experience. But she was fantastic. She was at 10, a perfect professional. And the test was so it was so simple and easy, very fast. And they're easy, you know, they're very willing to flex to your schedule. Like I said, yeah. She came here very early in the morning. I was the first appointment of the day. And there was, I believe, how many vials are there when you do the test?
So when we pull the test, we're taking 40 milliliters of blood. A vial can typically hold 10 milliliters of blood. We only pull 8 per vial instead of 10. That's because there's a couple milliliters of basically dextrose sugar in the tube in order to keep the cells alive during transit. So because we only pull 8 out of a tube instead of 10, it ends up being 5 tubes, but it's not 10 milliliter tubes. It's 5 tubes with 8 ml for 40 ml total.
Yeah. And the test is so thorough. I mean, I can't think of one person I know that hasn't been touched by the loss of cancer, or someone that's experienced or is experiencing cancer. And recently, just over the past few years, I've had just at a minimum of 5 friends, you know, close friends of mine that have had a diagnosis. And colorectal is common among men. And so men my age, I'm 47 now. Well, I'll be 47 in December. And there's been, I noticed an uptick of, you know, guys my age that I know with that diagnosis, the colorectal. So that's, you know, something to be, you know, checked out for sure. And then while I was going through the process of my Cancer Check Labs experience, as I was awaiting my test results, which thankfully came back negative, I called my mom. I called my folks out in Florida, and I was going to share that experience. And my mom had went in for an unrelated surgery, and they detected a 5-pound mass on her ovary, and she did not see that coming, you know. And so luckily they were able to remove that. But I just thought it was ironic that here I am taking this preventative measure while my mother was experiencing, you know, the sudden find. And like I said, some close friends of mine recently just went through bouts. I've had employees go through a very painful experience with cancer. And I wanted to have you on the podcast because I think spreading awareness is just huge. And if this podcast or Cancer Check Labs can help anybody, I mean, I think it's definitely worth getting the test. I mean, it couldn't have been more easy and convenient. And I thank you for that. I thank you for that because it gave me peace of mind. Because as I said, having just a couple of male friends of mine with the colorectal diagnosis that are my age and you know, that I've been close with for years, they were just blindsided by that. And you know, it definitely gave me peace of mind getting those test results back. So Thank you for that.
Of course. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about your mother's situation. I hope she's doing okay.
She is doing okay. Thank you.
Yeah, good. And so, you know, look, I mean, to your point, colorectal cancer is now the number one cause of cancer death in males under 50.
Yeah.
Colorectal cancer rates have also doubled in the younger population under 55 in the last 20 years. And so it's rising fairly rapidly. I mean, today cancer, unfortunately, has become just pervasive. It is completely indiscriminate. It does not care about socioeconomic status. It does not care about ethnicity. It does not care about race. To a large degree, it doesn't even care about age. I mean, pediatric cancers occur. People that are younger, below screening current age, and below current screening ages, are also having, you know, issues with cancer. A lot of screening doesn't even start until 40 or 45 today. And those screening protocols, there's typically five protocols that are deployed, and they vary depending on your gender. And so those five protocols include mammograms for breast cancer, colonoscopy for colorectal cancer, pap smear for cervical cancer, lung CT for lung cancer, and prostate exams and PSA for prostate cancer. Now, if you're male, you're not going to do a mammogram and a pap smear. So you're going to end up doing, you know, a PSA. You're going to end up doing a colonoscopy potentially if you adhere to it. And you might end up doing a lung CT only if the doctor prescribes it, which they usually don't, because they only do that with people that have risk factors. You're a smoker. You have some occupational hazard. You're a firefighter. You have a job history. So most people, they're going to, males, they're going to screen for colonoscopy, prostate, and they're done. And alternatively, for females, they're going to do mammogram, pap smear. They're not going to do a PSA. They're going to do a colonoscopy and then perhaps a lung CT if the same conditions apply. But there is nothing really to screen properly for gastric, pancreatic, liver, bladder, esophageal, thyroid, brain, skin, all the other organ tumors, more than half of the different tumors today have no standard screening. And so the goal here is, you know, if you want to move the needle, the key to curing cancer is early detection. Survival rates at stage zero are 99%. Pancreatic cancer is a perfect example. Pancreatic cancer is often a presumed death sentence. Pancreatic cancer is not a death sentence. Pancreatic cancer at stage four is often a death sentence. Pancreatic cancer at stage one is generally curable. In fact, stage one pancreatic cancers are usually broken into 1A and 1B. They don't normally find them. The way they find them is by accident. They'll be doing a procedure in your liver. They'll notice an abnormality in the tissue. They'll biopsy it somewhere and they'll go, oh my gosh, we found pancreatic cancer. But it's an accident because there's no standard screen. There's no symptoms. There's no easy way to diagnose it. But if they do find it in that rarity, which sometimes occurs at stage one, survival rates even for pancreatic at stage 1A are 85, at stage 1B are 85%. At stage 1A are 92%. So when you're talking about early detection, you're talking about moving the needle just the other way around.
Yeah.
And
what about, I wanted to ask about testicular cancer in men. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the statistics on testicular cancer? Because I know that that's alive and well too.
Yeah, it's rare. And in testicular, you know, look, it's alive and well, but it is a rare cancer. It is increasing in certain subpopulations. It's generally driven a lot by environmental exposure. I would say more so than genetics in that particular cancer type. You have to be careful with something like testicular cancer. I'm without naming another company. There was an article that came out in The Atlantic a couple months ago, I think in May, about a company that actually generated a false positive on testicular cancer. False positives are very dangerous.
Yeah.
You don't want false positives. They're more dangerous than false negatives. The reason false positives are more dangerous than false negatives is because false positives result in intervention. And so now you're going through biopsies, colonoscopies, you're going through PSA exams, you're going through imaging, screening. And at the end of that, if you have a false positive, they learn that you don't have cancer. And, you know, there's other companies that are based on what are known as ctDNA. ctDNA is circulating tumor DNA. So let's back up here for a second. So you have a tumor that's generating or shedding, rather, circulating tumor cells into the bloodstream. Circulating tumor cells are biological cells. They are messed up, malignant, dangerous, cancerous cells, but they are cells. They have the components of a cell. They have a nucleus. They have a genome with the DNA sequence. They have ribosomes. They have a cytoplasm. They have membranes. They have all the components of a cell. And so what ends up happening is when those CTCs are dislodged from a primary tumor, they basically will go through one of three events. They will go through cell apoptosis, which is programmed cell death, at which point the cell and all of its components will break into little bits and pieces, including the genome. And those scraps of the genome, i.e. scraps of DNA, or what they call circulating tumor DNA, ctDNA, will start floating around your blood. Or the cells will get eaten by your macrophages, your white blood cells, which is what's supposed to happen. It literally looks like a Pac-Man coming on and crunching the cell, and it will break it and shatter all the components, including the genome, where again, little scripts and scraps of DNA will be released into the blood. Or the third thing is they'll go through your capillaries. And as they go through your capillaries, the shear forces, the actual physical stresses will fracture the cells. And as they do that, again, they will break into bits and pieces with its components. And those bits and pieces, again, include circulating tumor DNA. So what a whole bunch of companies have been trying to do historically, which doesn't really work, is take these scripts and scraps of DNA and extrapolate from them, do we have a tumor cell? And to do that extrapolation, they use artificial intelligence, AI, machine learning, NGS, next generation sequencing, high capacity computational boxes, combinations thereof. The problem with that is it's a guess. And we can sit there and debate the quality of that guess. Some guesses will be better than others, depending on the quality of their algorithm. But fundamentally, it is a guess. And so that results in a lot of error. That results in a lot of error because these little scraps of DNA that are floating around your blood are faint. And because they are faint, they need to amplify the signal. And when they amplify the signal, they apply techniques that can mutate the DNA. So what ends up happening is they have healthy DNA come in, healthy samples. They do this amplification because they need more signal to detect it, much like they do PCR with viruses, the HIV in an occupational setting, there's rapid HIV tests in hospitals. They amplify the virus. That's what they're doing to get enough signal to detect it quickly. Same thing with COVID. They're amplifying it with PCR to get enough signal. And that's fine with an intact organism like a virus. But when you start amplifying unstable scraps of DNA, you will mutate them. And so they come out with false positives. In fact, one of the companies in the market comes out with a 56.9% false positive rate. That's a very high false positive rate. At that point,
that's very high.
You're better off flipping a coin. You'll only be wrong 50% of the time, not 56.9.
And
in that particular instance, 30% of those patients are going for the interventions that we just discussed. And the issues that, you know, practitioners and clinicians are running into in the market that we hear almost daily right now is that, you know, they get this false positive result from these tests. They send them through this car wash of workup. They come back and realize that it's a false positive. And they now they have to tell the patient the test was wrong. And the patient often doesn't believe them. The patient goes, no, the test said I have cancer. And they blame the doctor. And then they go, you just can't find it. And you've introduced this friction between the provider-clinician relationship and their patient. And you've introduced this unnecessary stress, anxiety, and all this unnecessary intervention because you gave them a false positive. The reason this all comes to mind at the moment is because you specifically asked about testicular cancer. This particular test, you know, there was an article about them, as I mentioned, in The Atlantic in May. And in that article, they got a false positive on testicular cancer, which resulted in a young male getting castrated. And so, you know, false positives is horrible. Like, you know, false positives are just fundamentally dangerous. Now, with our test, the cancer check, you know, you're not really going to see that. You're not going to see that because we're not using, you know, scripts and scraps and bits and pieces of DNA to try to extrapolate and guess, do we or don't we have a tumor cell? We don't guess. Like, we take the blood sample and we extract whole intact circulating tumor cells if they're present, and we identify them. Now, circulating tumor cells, when they're whole and intact, morphologically look fundamentally different than healthy cells. They're much larger. They'll be 40 microns instead of 10. They have multiple heads, i.e. multiple nuclei. They could have 6 nuclei instead of 1. They will be hyperchromatic, which means a lot of DNA because a lot of nuclear area. So there'll be just too much DNA in the cell, and you can stain it and see that. the nuclear footprint could take up 85, 90% of the cell instead of 15. So when a trained board certified pathologist that spends all day looking at tissue, and this is tissue, it's cellular tissue, looks at that, it is a slam dunk for them to go, this is a tumor cell and this is not. And yeah. So what that does is it sort of avoids the false positive problem that a lot of these other tests are struggling with, because they don't actually have the whole cell and they can't actually look at cellular tissue. That's why the output of their report comes from a machine, some algorithm, yeah, some black box, whereas the output of our report, of our test, is a board certified pathology report that every physician is comfortable with, because that's what they use for every single tissue biopsy in medicine.
Yeah, the opposition sounds like a very dangerous game of Russian roulette. You know, that's pretty scary. And you're trusting your provider. You know, you're putting your faith and your trust in that person. And to have that outcome, that's very startling, to have a castration happen out of that misdiagnosis.
Yeah, there's, you know, because that is one of the ways, you know, that is the primary way they biopsy a testicle.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's just, it's not one, it's rare, first of all, to get testicular cancer, since you asked, but, you know, there are instances, often environmentally exposed instances. You know, a lot of firefighters deal with that, for example. That's one subpopulation that has a very high incidence of cancer. We just started, I run two nonprofits at this time, and they're both 501c3s. One of them I started 12 years ago, after my sister passed, in her honor. And in that nonprofit, we fund cancer research at multiple institutions. Those include MD Anderson, Stanford, USC, City of Hope. We also fund underprivileged families to pay for their cancer care. We are also one of the largest registrars, wow, of bone marrow donors in the world. We've registered over 10,000 people in 300 drives across 60 cities. I was nominated for the National Board of LLS, Leukemia Lymphoma Society, for my contributions to combating cancer. That's one nonprofit. We started a second nonprofit about 45 days ago, and that's called Adopt a Firefighter. We're just launching that actually this month. And so Adopt a Firefighter was set up in order to screen every firefighter in the country. In exchange for the service that they provide to the community as first responders, they unfortunately have received one of the highest incidences of cancer of any subpopulation because of all the hazardous exposure.
Yeah.
You know? Asbestos, benzene, smoke, you know, all of that stuff day after day. Even the gear that they wear has some toxic chemicals in it that can be problematic. And so firefighters actually experience three times the incidence of cancer of the normal population. They don't die from, you know, fires and collapsing buildings generally. They die from cancer. It constitutes 72% of line of duty death. And so it's a massive problem for them. So we're starting by launching in our home city here in Dallas. In Dallas, we are going to screen the entire Dallas Fire Department. We're donating over $2 million worth of tests. We're going to raise a little bit for the rest of the fire department. And then once we do it here, we're going to expand that across the country to get all the firefighters screened.
Well, good Lord. I'm just blown away right now. You've been giving me goosebumps for a steady 5 minutes now. Congratulations, first of all, on your journey with your nonprofits. That's amazing. I have a nonprofit myself supporting individuals experiencing different abilities. Some multitude of folks and families I've worked with. I've worked in the nonprofit sector for 25 years. And, you know, it's very refreshing to hear the initiatives that you're taking on. And, you know, I'm a first responder. I'm not a firefighter, but I am a first responder and an instructor for American Red Cross. And that's huge. My gosh, thank you for all the service and initiatives that you're providing to the community and these individuals. It's amazing. I'm really blown away.
Likewise, thank you for your service as a first responder, as someone that's training at the American Red Cross.
I appreciate that. And we'll definitely have to provide links for all of these initiatives. I love sponsoring and supporting nonprofits. There's so many, you know, that touch my heart, and definitely yours is, you know, right up there. I'm happy to, you know, explore that and relationship build with you moving forward. Wow. I'm very today's a good day to talk to you.
Yeah, no, it's exciting. We have, you know, we welcome the support and the help, and we very much need all the help we can get. It's a big goal. There's, you know, 336,000 service firefighters across the country in the U.S. That are formerly on the service. A lot of people don't realize that there's actually 1 million firefighters overall, but 2/3 of them, about 640,000, are volunteers. And so in the country, we've got about 1 million firefighters, 1/3 of them on the service, 2/3 of them volunteers. You know, our goal would be to start with the service and then also be able to do the volunteers. We would also want to expand to retired firefighters because, you know, retired firefighters, it's difficult. Like, you finish the service, a lot of times they lose their medical coverage for things like cancer. They need to know a little bit earlier, and they actually had higher exposure than the active firefighters, A, because of age. They're generally on the service longer if they're retired. And B, you know, historically this changed, but, you know, when they were younger, a couple generation ago, maybe a few decades ago, they didn't actually wear protective gear and masks the same way. And yeah. So their inhalation exposure was much higher. And they also realized that some of the gear they were wearing had very toxic carcinogens that were seeping in through their skin. And so they had additional toxicity because of lack of protective gear, carcinogens in the gear that they actually wear, and then obviously age itself, which is just a primary risk factor for anyone with cancer.
Yeah. I think nowadays, though, it seems there's so many cancer-causing agents, and it, just being a human on its own is like experiencing Russian roulette where cancer is concerned because, no, like you said in the beginning of the podcast here, nobody's exempt from that. Nobody is exempt from it. I think the lung cancer diagnosis, too, I've known a few different folks that have that were not smokers that were, you know, experiencing a lung cancer diagnosis. And everyone, you know, is blindsided by that because these are people that live a healthy lifestyle. They exercise, they eat clean, so they think, and, you know, to their knowledge, they're doing everything right. And they're not, you know, smoking, they're not doing these things. And you can still end up with a lung cancer diagnosis, you know, thinking you're doing everything right. And so that's very scary. Back to the testicular cancer being so rare, I asked about that because through my nonprofit, I support a young man that beat testicular cancer, actually. He was, I think he must be about 8 years cancer-free from the testicular cancer diagnosis. I didn't really realize that that was as rare as you had said it is. I thought it was actually more common, but thank you for educating me on that.
Testicular cancer is generally more common in the younger population, younger males. So you'll see a higher incidence of it usually in people between 15 to 35.
Yeah.
Unless they end up with, you know, environmental exposures later.
Yeah, this was a younger man. He was a younger guy, like you mentioned. So yeah, that makes sense. You have a lot of initiatives happening here. So are you going to be part of the biohacking circuit on a regular basis as far as partnering with?
I'm speaking at RadFest next month. Both at the main stage and at, I think they call it the main city stage as well. There's like two different stages. I'm speaking on both the main and the offshoot. And then I'm also going to be involved with Concierge Medicine Forum in October. I'm speaking on the main stage at Dragonfly in October. We'll be active with A4M in December. So yes, we're just, you know, we entered the circuit by exhibiting at the ASPRE conference, the biohacking conference. It's the first time we've ever exhibited. It's the first time we've ever done a conference. This year, to build awareness, as you mentioned earlier, we're going to be doing a lot more conferences, and I'll be at virtually all of them.
Well, I really enjoyed meeting you. You had a great setup there for the event, for your exhibit. And I thought it was a very smart move that you had. I have my cowboy hat. So you had, if you signed up for a test, you got the cowboy hat with the Cancer Check Labs patch on there. And because Dave had the Space Cowboy disco party. So I love that. It's I see the hat every day. It's right by where I work out in my gym at home. And I think that, yeah, that's great that you're getting on the circuit and you're so well-spoken, you're so knowledgeable, and I thank you so much. You took the time to, I actually filmed you with my phone at the event at your booth there. And like I said, just on the drop of a dime, you just so well-spoken and so knowledgeable. And I really appreciate you and all the initiatives that you're taking. It's great work.
Thank you. I mean, look, our goal is to make an impact in cancer. You know, our company is very different than most companies. It was founded fundamentally with purpose. You know, the founders, myself, my partner, Denny, you know, we've all been, unfortunately, had experiences with cancer. I lost my only sibling, my younger sister, far too young, as I told you. He lost his brother when he was a teenager. He lost his parents, family members. So, I mean, cancer is just something that's affected all of us, and it's something we want to put an end to. And so that's why we got into this. That's why the company is also largely self-funded. That's why we don't have venture capital and private equity. You know, our goal over time is going to be when the company is big enough to start providing this across the world ubiquitously so everyone can do screening. That's going to mean when we go into areas like the third world, we're either going to have to subsidize or give away the test. So the way that we look at this is, you know, less of a company in that sense and more of a mission to have that right impact on humanity, because we have something very powerful.
Yeah, and that's beautiful.
We have the ability to really move the needle for the world, and we want to apply that. I mean, last year alone, there were 10 million recorded deaths in cancer. Over the course of 100, and there's more unrecorded, obviously. So not even accounting for population growth or the incidence of cancer rising rapidly in the younger and general population, as we discussed earlier, just keeping it flat at 10 million a year. That's in 100 years, one century, 1 billion lives lost. You're talking about double-digit percentages of global population being wiped out by cancer. I mean, at that point, it's a threat to humanity. And absolutely. So, you know, if you were to add up all casualties from all known wars in human history, the best historians estimate 350 to 400 million people. So the impact on life that you can have with just early detection, if you can move the mortality rates from where they are today to, you know, sub 1%, like you're actually in at stage zero, you're talking about an impact that's 2.5 times the size of all, you know, life that was lost in all known wars in human history in just one century.
It's amazing. You're a pioneer and a trailblazer with this initiative. I think I'm blown away. It's so good.
Thank you.
Yeah. You have a very important mission here. Summit, where can people find you? What are your handles?
So they can go to our website, cancerchecklabs.com. First off, they should follow us on social. There's two handles to follow. One handle is the company handle, you know, which is Cancer Check Labs. And the second, if they want to follow me, I'm putting some content up, Sumit Rai, Sumitrai Cancer. So if they want to follow Cancer Check Labs and Sumit Rai Cancer, they can find us there, and they can find a lot more content to learn about cancer.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And I definitely plan on staying in touch, and I definitely support this initiative. And again, thank you for giving me the peace of mind that provided me with Cancer Check Labs. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm glad we could do it. Peace of mind is very important. You know, peace of mind itself can have an impact on developing cancer. There's a lot of people that worry about cancer, and rightfully so. It affects their friends, their family, genetic history. They might have risk factors. They might have some symptoms. They don't know where they're coming from or what they are. And so when that occurs, people worry. You know, and depending on what level of hypochondriac you are, you could worry a lot. And when that starts occurring, that affects your hormonal balances. You start spiking cortisol, you know, you have stress hormones, and those hormones make it more likely for you to get cancer.
I wanted to ask, outside of obviously Cancer Check Labs testing is the number one prevention and peace of mind, but are there any cancer preventative measures that you recommend to anybody as far as wellness?
Yes, there's many things people can do to try to reduce the risk of cancer. I mean, first of all, simple exercise reduces your risk of cancer. Let's start there. And, you know, just a brisk walk for 20, 30 minutes a day can reduce your cancer risk about 30%. Start there. Second thing is, you know, to understand what to do to not get. So when you think about longevity, right, and lifespan, if you want to live a long time today and you want longevity, the one thing you must absolutely do is not die from cancer. Because, you know, cancer has, in many cases, in high-income demographics in developed countries, overtaken cardiovascular disease as the number one cause of mortality. So if, you know, 40% in NCI National Cancer Institute just increased it from 39.5 to 40.5 in just a few years. But over 40% of the population is going to get diagnosed with cancer. And so if you want to live a long time, the one thing you must do is not die from cancer. And the way to do that is to try to get ahead of it. And that really comes down to early detection. Now, that's to detect it early so that if we do find it early, it can be addressed early. That's detection is different than prevention. Early detection can help you prevent stage progression, going from stage one to stage two to stage three, stage four, because your practitioner, your clinician can intervene and treat you. But it doesn't, but early detection won't prevent cancer in itself, right? If we detect it, then you have it. So when we're talking about prevention, it's really lifestyle stuff. It's avoiding, you know, a lot of toxicity. For example, I was speaking on a story recently related to acne products. And, you know, there was some testing done with just, and these are household names, Estee Lauder Clinique, Target Up and Up, Clearasil, you know, just products for acne that, you know, a lot of people use when they were teenagers. So that's when they break out. And, you know, the problem with that is those products use benzoyl peroxide. Now, benzoyl peroxide in itself is not really that harmful. However, benzoyl peroxide is heat unstable. And because it's heat unstable, it can turn into benzene. And so when independent labs were testing these products, they found that they were generating, and benzene is a highly known toxic carcinogen. The acceptable levels of benzene, depending on what regulatory standard you're following, are 1 to 4 parts per million. When they tested these acne products with, you know, heat unstable benzoyl peroxide that turned into benzene, instead of 1 to 4 parts per million, they were generating up to several thousand parts per million. That's a problem. Like, that is a level of toxicity that you cannot apply to your body because it will damage your cells. It will cause inflammation. And damaged cells are basically mutated cells. They're precancerous cells. In most cases, your immune system is going to recognize that they're sort of something's off, something's wonky, these are foreign things, they shouldn't be there, and they will kill them. That's what your immune system does, and that's why we don't all die from cancer today. Unfortunately, if you add a lot of toxicity and a lot of inflammation, a breeding ground for lots of erroneous replications, and then you sort of turbocharge that with chemicals like this, you know, eventually your body will develop so many mutated precancerous cells that your immune system will miss them, and then they will multiply out of control. And when that happens, when it's evaded your immune system and begun to multiply as its own beast, is when people get quote unquote cancer. And so, you know, with this type of product, I mean, you know, it's, from my perspective, it's irresponsible to have it on the market if you're generating that level of toxicity. To make matters worse, who's using these products? Well, teenagers. Why are teenagers kids? Why are they using this product? Well, because they're going through puberty and they're breaking out. What happens during puberty? Your body surges with growth hormone. What does growth hormone do? It makes stuff grow. Good cells, bad cells, cancer cells, non-cancer cells. It just makes everything grow. It doesn't discriminate. So now you're going to take a highly toxic known carcinogen and apply it at thousands of times of the concentration you should to a kid, a teenager, while their body is surging with growth hormone to make any of those mutated precancerous cells grow more quickly. And then they sit here and wonder why they're seeing the incidence of cancer rise in the younger population. It's things like this. So you got to remove toxicity. A lot of it is about, you know, education.
Unfortunately,
a lot of people don't have the right content or the right information. And there's a lot of mixed information out there, and there's a lot of bad information out there. And, you know, Google is kind of great in terms of a resource, but it's a confusing place.
It's very confusing. That's a great point. Yes.
And so to be able to parse through all of that and understand what you should do, what you shouldn't do is complicated. You know, it's one of the things, if you're following us, you'll get some of this insight. We share a lot of this data and we share a lot of this information on our social accounts or Instagram accounts if you want to follow us. But even if you don't, become educated on that and avoid that toxicity. I think the second thing, so one thing I said was exercise. Second thing was to avoid toxicity, and give an example of this acne product. Third thing is, don't be so, and exercise falls into this, don't be sedentary. But the third thing is, don't eat so often. Like, we eat far too often. The human body was not designed to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That is a commercial construct. Right. That construct only started about 100 years ago with the advent of grocery stores, Piggly Wiggly in 1916 being the first one. And it was started to sell more groceries and eventually more cereal boxes and microwave meals and granola bars and whatnot, because we got to patch that time. For the vast majority of human existence, putting aside just the last 100 years, we didn't eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. There was no such thing. We generally lived in periods of feast and famine. And, you know, they'd go out, they'd hunt, they'd gather. And if they brought stuff back, they'd eat. And if they didn't, they'd fast. And so that famine stage where they were fasting is very important, because what that triggers are certain processes known as autophagy in your body. And autophagy is very, very important. But autophagy can't really get going until you're in a proper fasted state. And I know that a lot of people like intermittent fasting, and intermittent fasting definitely does have some benefits and different kinds of benefits, including autophagy. But to really get the benefits of autophagy, you actually need a much more extended fast.
Yeah.
And what autophagy is doing is it's going in during that period of time when you're still alive. You have cellular turnover as you're still alive constantly, right? Whether you're eating or not. But because you have that cellular turnover, in order to build those new cells as you're living, you need the building blocks of cells. And the building blocks of cells are amino acids, which come from proteins. So if you're in a famine state or a fasted state and you're not ingesting protein, your body still needs those amino acids to make those new cells. And so what your body will do is it will go out and it will find cells to break down. Now, this is where a lot of the nutritional myths come in, like bodybuilding myths. If you don't have a protein shake every 3 hours, your body's going to decompose and start eating healthy heart tissue.
Yeah.
That's complete nonsense.
Yeah.
Like your body is a highly sophisticated biological machine. It is not stupid. And it does not go there and self-cannibalize the most important parts of itself at the first opportunity it gets. Instead, what your body will actually do if you're in an autophagic state, and just so people understand, auto means self, phagy means eating. It's self-eating in Greek. It's literally in kind of your internal cellular recycling program. What your body's going to do in that more advanced autophagic state is go and look for two things. A, it's going to look for underperforming dysfunctional cells. Do you have bad liver cells? Do you drink a lot? And it's going to break those down, get rid of those dysfunctional underperforming cells, use those amino acids to rebuild healthy cells,
which is
going to make your body perform better. And number two, it's going to look for cells that have shortened telomeres. Telomeres are these strands on cells that essentially have our DNA blueprint for replication. And so what ends up happening is, and over time as you age, telomeres shrink. And as they shrink, that's the equivalent of the blueprint shrinking and fading. And so as the blueprint is sort of fading away, the probability of an erroneous replication increases. And so what your body will do is it will go and it will, an erroneous replication, i.e. a precancerous cell. So what your body will do is it will go out and it will find the cells with shorter telomeres, selectively break those down for base amino acids, leaving only the cells with longer telomeres, which then increases your weighted average length of your telomeres across the cells in your body, which in turn improves the fidelity of that cellular replication blueprint, which thereby reduces the risk of an erroneous, i.e. precancerous cell. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done to try to prevent cancer. I mean, myself, you know, I generally try to fast about, in the last few months, I'm going to do it as frequently, but I did one last month. I generally try to fast about 5 days a month. Now, anyone should see their health provider and make sure their doctors are okay with that and their health conditions that preclude them. But personally, I fast for 120 hours about every month. So I'll usually start my last meal on Sunday night, and then I won't eat till Friday night about once a month. And so what that does is it reduces systemic inflammation. It'll reduce your blood pressure. It will actually help you prevent diabetes, or even if you have diabetes, potentially improve it, because it will improve insulin sensitivity. And diabetes is essentially insulin resistance, which is why they have to supplement with shots or pills, more insulin, Humalog, et cetera. And then from a cancer perspective, obviously, while you're in that fasted state, you're cleaning up dysfunctional cells, you're cleaning up inflammation, which is a breeding ground for precancerous cells, you're cleaning up potentially precancerous cells themselves, and you're taking out the short telomere cells, so you improve the chances of making sure that all your cells are replicated correctly.
What are your recommended sources of protein?
So, I personally use unflavored whey.
Okay, so I do too. I do too.
Yep, and the way I flavor it, you know, I do like the flavor. So I'll either have some coffee in there mixed in, usually cold brew because it's stronger. I might even throw a little bit of lemon juice into it. A few teaspoons of that is not going to kill you for those people that are worried about keto and carbs. But you know, you can make kind of a lemonade out of it. But I find that to be better than some of the packaged stuff. There's just a lot of chemicals involved in flavor.
Yeah.
And a lot of those chemicals, even in like, you know, candies recently, Skittles, M&Ms, things like that, you know, the red, blue, five, all that stuff is known to cause cancers. You just don't want that stuff in your body.
No. Yeah, I gave up candy years ago. Every now and again, you know, a treat's nice, but like that's not my that's not my everyday practice. But yeah, whey protein for sure. Yeah, exactly. That's my source too. And I do love cold brew. I go through different bouts of just giving things up for a period of time. It's kind of like intermittent fasting, but I'll do it with like coffee. I switch from for a period of time. I'll switch from coffee to green tea and matcha and things like that, and then I revisit down the road, reintroduce with all different food sources and beverages.
And those things all have different benefits too. I mean, fundamentally they all have lots of antioxidants, but some of the antioxidants have different mechanisms. But then separate from the antioxidants, they have phytonutrients, and different phytonutrients have different mechanisms that can even work against cancer, other inflammatory conditions. They can work against autoimmune disorders. Like there's a lot of benefit to those things.
I got into those because into biohacking also because I had a diagnosis of an autoimmune disorder called alopecia areata. It was triggered by stress, and so you have to do a whole lifestyle change, even though these were things I knew prior to that diagnosis. But while I was starting up my nonprofit, I experienced several hurdles that were very stress inducing and kind of triggered that for me, as far as I understand it. And it was looking like it was going to shift from alopecia areata to alopecia totalis, which is complete loss of all hair on your body. But I was able to reverse that due to, you know, kind of finding my way to the Biohacking Network, Dave, and all the great folks that Dave brings together for the conference, and different alternative methods that have helped me restore everything and my gut healing process and everything that comes with, you know, having an AI.
For sure. I mean, autoimmune disorders are, you know, difficult, right? It's your own body attacking itself. Now there's a lot that can be done, fortunately, for them, especially today. There's a lot of ways to slow down that inflammation. Essentially, you have a hyperactive immune system. And so, you know, you need to help it kind of calm down. I'm familiar with it. I have vitiligo, you know, I lose some pigment.
So okay.
Immune disorder, right? Where basically your immune system will attack, attack your pigment cells, your melanocytes, it'll kill them. And that's why you lose pigmentation in that part of the skin. And so even with that, I've had it for about 20, 25 years at this point, and, you know, was able to stabilize it and have it stop.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I so with the alopecia diagnosis came a little bit of vitiligo. I was experiencing skin pigmentation because I ended up with the spots, the circle spots, patches on my beard, on my face, and my eyebrows, on my scalp, and on areas of my lower body too. Mm-hmm. And so I had noticed that vitiligo was playing into that, so I did my research on that, but I didn't experience it to a stressful level, but yeah, I can appreciate that. Wow.
For sure. But, but again, all addressable, you know, fortunately not life threatening in that sense, but you know, still annoying things you want to, you know, not have to deal with.
Yeah. It feels like it's out of out of your control, but really, you know, like you said, the body is a sophisticated, well-oiled machine that, you know, can heal itself if you're treating it properly. And that's where I took my power back and, you know, reinvested in, you know, what I was putting in my body, eating for fuel, not pleasure, cutting out all toxicity. And, you know, I also found my way into juicing vegetables and incorporating that into my diet. And I go through ebbs and flows of that. So I think when I talk about juicing with people, they think that like, that's all I do. No, I eat in addition to, but I'm eating for fuel and I'm just incorporating like clean green juice, things like this.
You know? Phytonutrients.
Yes, absolutely.
There are a lot of accidents that you're picking up by doing that, which is great.
Yeah, thank you. Well, gosh, yeah, you're a wealth of knowledge. I mean, did we drop the handles for your nonprofits also?
So we're setting that up right now. So okay. It's going to be, I don't know when you're releasing this, but it's going to be adoptafirefighter.life. Let's focus on that one for now because we're launching that one.
Gotcha. But,
we just received our 501c3 a few days ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So now it's all official. It's proper public charity and all donations will be tax deductible for anyone that wants to contribute. So we're just getting that set up because we got it a couple of days ago. It'll be set up in the next few days. At that point, I absolutely would encourage everyone to go donate. The website is adoptafirefighter.life. We will be setting up nonprofit handles. I believe we already have Adopt a Firefighter on Instagram, but I'll have to check.
Fantastic. I'll be sure to follow and I'll be sure to make a contribution. Absolutely. I think it's Thank amazing. You. When does it officially launch? The podcast will be released within the next few weeks. You know,
It'll be launched before that.
Perfect. Beautiful.
Like within less than a week.
Well, count me in.
Awesome.
Sumit, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I hope to have you back and I hope to have you back profiling more of your initiatives and help you, you know, on your pioneering efforts. I think you're amazing.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Give me an opportunity to share a bit.
Absolutely. And I know that we'll see each other again on the biohacking circuit.
I'm sure we will. I'm sure we'll see each other soon.
Yes. All right. Again, thank you so much. And it was a pleasure.